Hello?
Hello.
Hi.
There is nothing quite like new room smell, isn't it? It's wonderful. For those who remember the old Langvale North, this is night and day difference. So I guess we are now in the Vorenberg room. This is not our federalism changing notions of the Constitution in the latter part of the 20th century. This is internet and society. There strike me as being more people here than the registrar thinks is here. You know you shouldn't get on the bad side of the registrar, so please figure out if you're actually in the class, even though at this moment you are in the class. And it also would be great to fill in the front rows. There will actually be a frequently asked questions document handed out at some point, which will raise the specter of cold calling. And it's true that my myopia might actually incline me to call in the front row first. But despite that, you should sit in the front row. Do I need this mic, or am I? Yes, I think we have at least 12 now among the LLMs rather than 2. Are you saying that there's actually some lack of efficiency between the registrar's office and... I am shocked. Shocked and saddened. I might hope at least that those LLMs who actually really want to be in the class are here nonetheless, an act of civil disobedience for which I congratulate you. If that's the case, then welcome, and we'll sort out the details later. In fact, you'll notice we have some slides. I thought this being rumored to be an internet class, I had to have slides. I'm not particularly fond of them, but here they are nonetheless. At least I've spared you the Microsoft Word templates that you can use with these things, like the happy globes. And anyway, so here's what I wanted to do today. I wanted to tell a story that will illustrate what this course is going to be about in large part, and then actually just tell you what the course is going to be about in large part, and then, of course, what to expect and not, and then get ready for next week. So let's see here. Oh, yeah, don't expect a lot of slides. It's too easy to become a slave to the slides. I don't know if you've noticed this phenomenon where that I'm just sort of like reading them and you're reading them and I could just give them to you if that were the case. So don't expect a lot of them. And there, they just disappeared. So that was the PowerPoint presentation. So I wanted to start with a story, and a story that would be for most of you off the beaten path. But a story nonetheless about the internet and about the quite ambitious subtitle of this class, The Technologies and Politics of Control. And the story is a story about ICANN. I don't know how many people, well, I might as well do an Insta poll. How many people have heard of ICANN? Wow. All right. Increasing numbers have heard of ICANN. Berkman staffers, don't raise your hands. I'm going to tell that story. And it begins, actually, at the beginning of the internet as we know it, when in the late 60s, people got the bright idea of taking the computers they were developing and hooking them to each other. Hooking them to each other produced a number of problems. Pornography is not the only one, despite what you may have been reading in the paper. Indeed, early pornography was limited to so-called ASCII art, these little characters that you had to really hold it. Anyway. Research. If you hooked one computer to one other computer, that wasn't that difficult to figure out. Because if you got some data and it wasn't yours, it was fairly safe to assume it was the other computer's. It's kind of like I and thou. But as soon as you got to computer number 3, things got a little bit confusing. And it took a while to get to computer number 3 because data was actually exchanged in large part by actually, if you're going to use, say, a modem, a modulator, demodulator, you actually hook the computer up to the phone line, call another computer, and then you would talk. And you didn't do computer conference calling in those days, kind of 976 computer chat. You would just have two computers talking to each other, and that would be the end of the story. And you knew who you called because you knew what phone number you had dialed. But there were some brilliant innovations in the 60s that had to do with packet switching. It said, what if we had just a common network, and you actually had a bunch of computers able to hook up to it all at once? That would be really good because you wouldn't have to keep calling other computers. And it would also mean that you could scale it. You could just keep introducing computers. And so long as you kept straight some scheme for knowing what data came from whom and for whom it was intended, everything would go really well. So they came up with what, at this point, might sound like an obvious scheme, which was, let's just number every computer. Give it a unique number, and that way, so long as you knew your number and you knew the number of the computer you wanted to talk to, you would just say, this is number 5 calling for number 9. I've got some data for you. And if you were computer number 12, you'd see the data, and it was not addressed to number 12, so you'd just pass it right down the pipe, and eventually you'd hope that somebody near the pipe would be the computer for which the data was destined. So that's what they did. They created numbers, what we now know as Internet Protocol numbers, IP numbering. IP went through several versions. From my understanding, the first version actually was serial numbers. You know, you just had a bunch of numbers. They later broke those numbers into hierarchies. So today, an IP number assigned to a computer, assigned to these computers, the minute they hook up to the internet at least, is something like 128.36.0.19. And there's a hierarchy to it, and it's actually structured in a way that it's possible to run out of numbers. If there are math people here, you might think it's not possible to run out of numbers. There are plenty of them. But not with IP. You can run out of numbers, and in fact, they're getting scarce. So scarce that now you have to pay for numbers. And part of the money you pay to AOL if you get on, or that Harvard pays en masse when they assign the numbers downstream to people like us, is just for the privilege of having a big pile of numbers. Now you might also think that for this to work, somebody would have to keep the numbers straight. You just have to know at least what numbers were assigned and what weren't. Because you can't give the same number out twice. If you do, the obvious confusions would arise as data sails across the network, destined for one computer but overheard then by another that thinks it has the same number. So a guy who was among the researchers doing this, and it'll actually be important very soon to say who are the researchers that do this, a guy who did it said, all right, I draw the short stick, I'll keep track of the numbers. Rather boring job, he at least had the help of a computer, he started handing out numbers. His name was John Postel, researcher at the Information Sciences Institute at the University of Southern California. He'd done his PhD thesis on these kinds of problems and just agreed he'd help hand out the numbers. Indeed, a lot of his research was funded by the government, kind of the way the government to promote wonderful and pure art supports the National Endowment for the Arts. You know, there's the Natural Science Foundation which promotes natural and pure science. So he starts handing out numbers, and there are some inadequacies. One inadequacy is it's really hard to remember numbers. And as you're actually starting to network more and more, you want to be able to remember what computer number you want to talk to, and just the numbers aren't very helpful. Now, one way you could do it is just by what Netscape does, like with bookmarks. You see a site, it has a really long URL at the top to go to, you don't have to remember it, you bookmark it, you give it whatever name you want, and then you go to your bookmark. The only problem is that your bookmarks aren't the same as anybody else's, so on a business card, if you were conveying the name of the site, you'd still have to give that long identifier rather than the title of your bookmark, because after all, it's just your bookmark. So they came up with the idea of names, to start naming the computers. Fred, Dave, Joe, Amy. From what I can tell, there were both genders represented in this early scheme of names. And somebody just, again, had to keep a central list of them. If you had two Joes, that would be one Joe too many as far as the naming scheme was concerned. And indeed, if we were to depict this in a computer science kind of way, it would look like this. You'd have a big list. And somebody would just keep this list, and inside of it would be all these names. Now, MIT actually drew the short straw this time and agreed to keep the list, a file called hosts. And if you were on the network, every so often you would go grab the authoritative hosts file from MIT, and that would tell you what the latest names were. Fred is no longer at this IP address. He has since moved to this other IP address. And there's a new guy on the block now, Joe, and you know, here's how to reach Joe. So you constantly had to go back to MIT to fetch the file to make sure you were up to date. And at the same time, anytime you wanted to add a computer to the network that would have a name, you'd have to call MIT to do it. This is a lot like besieging the registrar's office to see if you can get into a class on a single day when everybody else wants to get into the class. This doesn't scale, which in computer science terms means if you make it big, it breaks. So it started to break. And they had to put their heads together to figure out what a new scheme would look like. Now you might say, who is the they who put their heads together? Well, let me at least show you the results of what it was. That's right, RFC 883. It turns out that John Postel, the guy in California, and a number of others, originally about a dozen of them, They were all researchers at academic institutions, or they worked at computer companies that had a great interest in networking, and in their spare time would talk about this nascent network. They would get together and just figure out how to do things, because at least you need to have everybody on the same page. If there's going to be agreed that there will be a list, we've got to know that, all right, this is what the list will look like, this is how literally a computer reads the list, this is how it gets parsed, and this is who will keep it. So they actually started getting a little bit formal, a little bit. For instance, you may have heard of something called the IETF, the Internet Engineering Task Force. Now, the IETF has no headquarters, it's not incorporated, has no legal personality, it can't sue or be sued. It's just a notion. You don't pay dues to it. Anybody now can suddenly declare himself or herself a member of the IETF, although that might prompt questions that you then wouldn't want to actually answer or conversation you wouldn't want to have about IP numbering schemes. The IETF meets every so often. In next week's readings, you'll see a little bit of something called the DAO of the IETF, which is the frequently asked questions about the IETF written by IETF members that gives you a sense of what it's like. These meetings, again, get agreed upon, you have a date, you all get in one room, you argue a lot about IP numbers, and at the end you see if you've reached consensus on a technical issue. How do you know if you reach consensus? You take a hum. Everybody in the room is asked to hum their approval. The idea being no matter how passionately you feel about something, you can only hum so loud. And you'll actually see on the IETF mailing lists where they discuss things when they're not in these meetings, you know, that'll never get past a hum, and that's what that means. Indeed, the IETF motto, such as it is we reject kings, presidents, and voting. We believe in rough consensus and running code. It's a wonderful motto, and one that the IETF members I know take to heart very much, and they never take votes. They only take hums or call for consensus. Consensus is a magic word. Now, with it, they'll also appoint, elect, declare that there are certain chairs of working groups, people who own the quill, the pen, that actually writes down the final standard. That brings us back to RFC 883, because RFC 883 is Request for Comments number 883. As you might notice now, these guys love numbering things, so they started coming out with documents that describe proposals for standards, and so you could keep the documents straight, they started numbering them, and somebody was the keeper of all the numbers of the documents. In fact, John Postel was the keeper of the number of the documents. So it started with RFC number 1, and by this time, this is now, we're talking, I think, 83 or so, 1983, they were up to RFC 883. You can go to www.ietf.org and read some RFCs if you like. I recommend it if you are having trouble falling asleep. But let me just give you a quick glimpse of RFC 883. Now, you might think, by the way, that RFC 883, Request for Comment, means just that. You know, I'd like people to comment upon this. And it does mean that. And how do you comment? You go to the author who wrote the RFC and you send them comments. And then the author goes through a wonderful process. The author says, these are the good comments, I'll adopt them. These are the bad ones, I'll forget them. And then comes out with another RFC. Eventually, the RFC becomes final. At that point, it's no longer a request for comment, it's just final. This is the protocol. Of course, it carries no legal force. There's no law that says you have to follow it. It simply is final because those in a position to implement it, and it would be worthwhile to reflect on who would those people be, start doing so. RFCs govern things like simple mail transfer protocol. When you use Eudora or Outlook or your IE or Netscape mail, it's POP3 compliant. They also love acronyms, as you can tell, which means that it follows a particular RFC that describes this is how you send email. After all, when I send email to a mail server, it expects a certain form to be followed, and if I don't follow it, it gets confused and the email doesn't get to where it's supposed to go. So here is RFC 883, which touches on domain names. And you can see it's written in that 1983 way of where the charts aren't really charts. They're ASCII art of the sort. That's actually what they came up with instead of the list. Now, there's a way, actually, in which when you do it with ASCII text, it actually looks scarier than it really is. I'll just try to describe it very quickly, what this actual system is. It solved the problem of scalability of the list brilliantly, because it did two things. The first thing it did was it said, you know what, we're going to break up the list. we're going to fragment the namespace so the different pieces of it are in different places, and that way there's not just one registrar's office. You could imagine a registrar's office for people with names A through M and one for N through Z. Now you've cut your problem in half. Or in this case, you might imagine a registrar's office for law school classes that actually doesn't interface at all to the registrar's office for FAS classes or to B school classes, that kind of thing. That's a way of taking what would be a big list and breaking it up into hierarchies. And they did just that. So let's follow, it's actually worth it to do this. Let's follow the path that a traditional domain name as we know it today takes when it resolves itself to a number. Because before you can get anywhere on the internet, you actually need that number. And there's a bunch of rabbits getting pulled out of hats to get you to where you're going when all you type in is www.cnn.com or something like that. Here's how it works. In fact, it might be even a better slide, because if you go down in this document, things only get bigger. Back off here. Ah, yes, this is a much nicer looking chart. So there's the new and improved domain name service. It has a name now, domain name service, DNS. And it's a hierarchy now, it's a chart. So what happens is, first, you jump to the root. Suppose we have a name that is www.cnn.com. We want to know what is the corresponding number for that. First, we go to the root. The root is a designated place, just agreed upon ahead of time, ab initio, and you say, all right, root, I'm looking for a computer that can tell me something about .com, because I've got a .com name I have to deal with. And the root says, I know where that is, here's the address. So you leave the root knowing where you can find out about .coms. It's like going to the information kiosk at Harvard and saying, I'd like the registrar's office for the law school, please, can you tell me where that is? And they send you to the right place. Then you go to the .com list, and you say at the .com list, hi, I'm looking for CNN.com. Can you tell me where there's a computer that would know where CNN.com is? And the person that runs the com list says, yeah, I know about that, and sends you to a third place. The third place is the CNN.com place. And you say, hi, I'm looking for www.cnn.com. Can you tell me where that is? And CNN.com tells you where to find that. You at last get the number you were looking for, and off you go to www.cnn.com. This is brilliant because not only has it broken up the list into fragments, so it disperses the traffic, but it means that every time CNN.com wants to add another computer to the network and give it a domain name, it doesn't have to consult the guy that runs the .com list. It can just make www2.cnn.com or video.cnn.com. And it makes those entries in the CNN.com computer that it runs, and the only thing the guy that runs com upstream has to know is here's where the CNN.com people are. Is this making relative sense? We need those like dials where as it gets boring or incomprehensible, you turn the dial and you can watch more. Next class. Okay, so here's actually a graphic depiction of this. You go to the root. You say, hi, I'm looking for com, and then you say, I'd like AOL.com. You go to there, and they say, all right, I'd like boomer98.aol.com, and that's where you go. Now, you might ask with this, well, first, let's just say this. Somebody has to maintain these lists, right? So John Postel agrees to do it. He starts out actually maintaining the .com list. So if you want to create a .com, you call up John on the phone, or you send him an email, or you fill out a form, and he'll add it to the list for you. What does he charge? Zero. Doesn't cost anything. But if you ask for too many, it might take him a while to get around to it. Or he'll say, why do you need so many? Which is what happened. People would get excited sometimes about adding domains. Yeah, come on. Just don't bother me with so many. I'll give you three. And that's how you got names. You go to John for it. Now, eventually, John got tired of doing this. He decided, in his own words, there wasn't enough money the NSF could give him to simply maintain a boring list. So he went back to the National Science Foundation and said, can you find somebody else to do this? Why don't you put out a contract? So they did. They put out a contract for somebody to maintain .com, .net, and .org. Now, you might say, by the way, .com, .net, and .org, where did those come from? There's an RFC on it. At some point, that was decided that that's what you'd have. There are so-called, these are generic top-level domains we're talking about, com, net, org, mil, gov. Bonus, if you can name the remaining three, there are eight of them today. If you try to go to .biz, the root hasn't heard of .biz. It's like going to the Harvard University Information Kiosk and say, hi, I'd like the registrar's office for the School of Forestry. And they would say, I'm sorry, there isn't such thing. And similarly, the root today would tell you there is no .biz, so no name any in .biz goes anywhere on the net because the root hasn't designated anybody to maintain a list of .bizes. So there's those generic top-level domains, and at the same time, John realized that there were countries, other people in the world, who knew, that wanted to register names. And actually, you know, it's a long-distance call to call John out in California. He decided, why don't I create some country codes so the United Kingdom can have .UK. And then I'll let somebody over in the United Kingdom run it, and nobody will bother me to add stuff. You might think of this as like his last resort before giving away .com was just to try to divert some of the traffic. Now, he quickly realized that this might entail him engaging in foreign policy, because if the Palestinians came to him and say, hi, we'd like the Palestine country code, please, he'd have to decide whether to give it to them. And decided he didn't want to do that. So he said, I need a list. Somebody find for me an authoritative list of countries, and preferably two-letter abbreviations, because I want to head off a fight between Paraguay and Panama as to who will get the .pa ending, leading to the lucrative grand.pa domain. So he found such a list. The list is from the International Standards Organization, ISO, a non-profit, quasi-treaty organization that decides things like what the flange on your AC outlet, how big it should be. Someone has to do that. List number 3,166 of the ISO is a convenient list of countries and two and three-letter abbreviations for them. So he said, that's it. Whatever ISO 3166 says, that's the list of countries I support and the corresponding two-letter codes. By the time he did that, it was too late for the United Kingdom. That's actually GB in their list for Great Britain. So he grandfathered in UK, reserved GB, because now what do you do, and granted the rest of the names. Of course, there were a number of countries that weren't yet ready for this dubious gift of a two-letter ending in a file on a computer at the University of Southern California. So for those, he operated them in trust. He would find somebody who would be the trustee for the name that could just exercise good judgment and enter names. So for a long period of time, a gentleman in Switzerland registered most of the Central African names under the corresponding country codes. You go to that guy, and would he charge you? Maybe. Yeah, it's up to him. That kind of thing. And so he would delegate these country codes to other people to run it. Now, the United States of America has a country code, .us. .us is currently being held in trust for that time. The U.S. government chooses to, kind of like in Star Trek announcing you've discovered warp and then you get welcome to the Federation. I promise that's the last Star Trek reference. The whole, I didn't have a habit of it last year. I'm not going to start now. It's just too good an analogy, though, for those of you who know. The United States has not yet achieved warp. It has not yet agreed that it's ready to take on the responsibility of running .us. So to this day, .us is run in trust for the United States government by John Postel and his successors. And indeed, if you're the mayor of Cambridge, you'd call up John eventually and say, hi, I'd like cambridge.ma.us. And he'd say, I'm sorry, the city council has it. Go settle it with them and then come back to me when you're ready. Okay, so enter NSI. Fast forward ahead 10 years, 1993, very significant year in the advent of the Internet, because now we've got the World Wide Web. People are actually starting to point and click their way through the net rather than sitting at IETF meetings talking about protocols and then using them to implement email programs which are then used to talk about protocols. Suddenly the Internet is about something other than the Internet. And corporations are starting to find it. 1992 and 93 saw the first time that advertising actually came to be on the net. Can you believe it? There was a time when there was not advertising on the Internet. And those brave souls who dared to advertise their products were actually spammed with mail themselves and driven and ruined off the Internet. They've actually written quite lucrative books out of it, which are not part of this course's assignments. So anyway, enter NSI. What is NSI? Network Solutions, Inc., a company that stepped forward to answer the call of the National Science Foundation, saying we need somebody to agree to keep these lists, COM, Org, and Net. Those are the three biggies that we're starting to get lots of registrations. And we'll just pay you. We'll just pay you a flat amount of money every year to keep these lists. The initial contract was to the tune of, I think, around $5 million for 5 years to keep these lists. So Network Solutions won that bid. there in Reston, Virginia, and agreed to start taking registrations. Now, the catch of it was that a couple of years later, NSI came back to the National Science Foundation and said, you know, we live in an era of cost recovery. Privatizing government is all the rage. What do you say we charge for each name? And that way, you don't have to pay us. You can even keep the $3 million, and instead, we'll just charge, oh, I don't know, $35 a name, $70 for 2 years on a name. Roughly up front, $100 comes to us anytime somebody wants a name. NSF agreed, and thus did Network Solutions go from a somewhat sleepy company with a backwater government contract. As these names became more and more of interest, as of last year, Network Solutions was registering or re-registering approximately 300,000 names per month at about $100 a crack. Leads to significant amounts of money even for a jaded federal government. Enough so that other people want in on the action. Also realize that at this time domain names are becoming increasingly important because in browsers, there's that line up at the top. It says, where do you want to go today? And you type in an address. And you might type an address that you saw on the side of a bus. There was an era, if people remember it, where you had like AOL keywords or something, and sure enough, sometimes in the paper you'd say AOL keyword CNN, and if you were on AOL, you'd say go CNN, and off you would go. Well, this was the Uber keyword. This was www.cnn.com. Put that on the bus, and if they have a browser and they're on the internet, that'll take you there. So these names started to have serious marquee value, and this leads to a set of problems. Oh, I think they arrived one by one. Yes. So problem number one. Network Solutions is a cash cow. That's not a problem for Network Solutions, but other entrepreneurs want a piece of the action. And people start saying, you know, I'll run .biz and I'll do it at $15 a name. Right? Now, who would you direct that offer to? Well, I suppose at the end of the day, it's whoever runs the root, right? Because it's the person that runs the root that could decide whether there was a .biz, and if so, who fills in the name under it. So for the longest time, who ran the root? John Postel. So you'd go to John and you'd say, hi, I'd like .biz, I'll do it, I'll even give you 10% off the top. And what did John say? John said, no, it would not be in the best interest of the internet. It's a very strange reaction from somebody offered millions of dollars to make a three-character change in a file. John wore sandals. He was not necessarily an entrepreneur of the business type. And this started irking people. I mean, why wasn't he going along with the show? For John's part, it was not just a belief that that wasn't in the best interest of the internet. It was also an increasing belief that the way that he had made changes before through this RFC process wouldn't be so easy to do. And I'll get back to that in a second, but I want to detail some of the other problems. Problem number two, corporate America and the world discover cyber squatting. What is cyber squatting? It sounds vaguely obscene. If you ask some people, they'll say it is. Cyber squatting is the act of registering a domain name that actually you don't really intend to use, that you intend, God forbid, to sell to someone else that might want to use it. That's right, creating a market in domain names. Now, corporate America discovered domain names after the kind of people that go to IETF meetings did. As a result, Hertz.com was not in the hands of Hertz America Rent-A-Car, Inc. at the time Hertz decided that's what they wanted. Some guy in Colorado had it. In fact, some guy in Colorado had a big pile of domain names, McDonald's.com, you know, companies wanted these things and felt somewhat uncomfortable that they felt they were being extorted to have to pay this guy just to have their own name, for God's sake, in the space. So trademark interests got upset. And indeed, there wasn't completely fair play between competitors. In a famous case, the Princeton Review had registered Kaplan.com and was putting out nasty things about Kaplan. And MCI actually found that MCI.com had been taken by Sprint. These things were resolved in a puff of smoke in a backfilled room, and we didn't get a lawsuit out of it. But there's just general trouble over that. So this leads to the question, expand the namespace? Why not have .biz and .this and .that? What's the big deal? And indeed, here they appear one by one, some possible domain names, .per, There's actually a guy running around out there, Sue. So far as I can tell, one of his primary applications is claiming the rights to .perf. Now, these rights don't amount to much with the domain name system as we know it, because if you ask the root for .perf, it doesn't know anything about it. That has not stopped this guy from registering a bunch of names under .perf, so when the day comes that he's introduced into the root, all of his customers are suddenly recognized. It's also the idea of maybe a .xxx domain. Why not put all porn under .xxx? And that way, we'll just make the browsers so they can't visit .xxx if a young child's fingers are upon them, and we'll solve the pornography problem. And there's also, you know, why not have other languages represented? You know, it's weird. It's so English-centric, these domain names. And indeed, America-centric. .gov is not world government. It's the American government. .mil is the U.S. military, and so on. So, and there's .web. There are several people claiming the rights to .web right now. So what's the solution? One solution might be John thinks hard, makes a decision, and adds the names. That's a common way for John to resolve problems in engineering on the internet. He decided not to do that. Another solution is he thinks hard, he does an RFC and adds the names. He puts it through the RFC process. He goes to these meetings of the IETF. They decide whether they want to do it. They take the hum. He goes back. He writes the draft. He gets the comments and blah, blah, blah. Away you go. He decides he can't do that either. It's too politicized at this point for the reasons I've described. So what's the third solution? Convene a committee. That's what John does. He convenes a committee. What does he convene? The IAHC. That's right. The Internet Ad Hoc Committee. Has anybody here served on the Internet? No? Okay. So there's an Internet Ad Hoc Committee. They get together in Geneva, and they have meetings, and they come out with a document at the end of the day. The document is this. The GTLD MOU. If you learn nothing today, at least you'll come away for the cocktail party you'll be going to tonight or tomorrow, so you can say, I know what the GTLD MOU is, properly capitalized, I might add. It is the Generic Top-Level Domain Memorandum of Understanding. And this was meant to be the document that would just break the logjam and solve this problem of names. Here is the GTLD MOU. They come out of Geneva and wave it around. February 28, 1997, and you'll notice in brackets, in red letters, is somebody annotating the GTLD MOU who doesn't like it very much. So it starts with the Internet Community 1997, and in brackets, actually, they do not speak for the Internet community, including consumers, ISPs, content providers, marketers, technology developers, etc. And then they have a considering, a conscious, and a recognizing clause, all necessary to a good MOU. And then they're of the view. And they have a whole bunch of stuff. And now here is the MOU. And what does the MOU do? It creates an alphabet soup of structure. Please do not take notes on this. There is a policy oversight committee, a POC. There is a CORE, a council of registrars. There's a whole bunch of people who are thought to have an interest in this that somehow get appointed to one committee or another that together frame policy. Subject only to the IANA, the Internet Assigned Numbers Authority. What is the IANA? The IANA has no legal personality. It's not incorporated anywhere. The IANA actually is another name for John Postel. She'd freely admit. It's just another way of saying, well, the IANA wouldn't do it. That means John wouldn't do it. The Internet Society was also involved. It was the Internet Society, but it lacked the legal front for the IETF. Worrying about getting sued, they decided to actually incorporate a separate entity that would be generally for the promotion of the Internet. It was called the Internet Society. It does have a headquarters. It does have officers. And it appears to largely mirror the people who do such great work in the IETF. So anyway, they come up with this proposal. And the proposal, when you boil it down, says two things. One, we're going to add some new names immediately. .nom. .art, .rec, .firm, .store. Okay, we're going to add some new names to the root. The second thing it does is it says, for any future names after that, we're going to put it through this particular process. And the process means that the POC thinks about it, it makes a recommendation, it goes to the core thinks about it. It's quite a sausage-making experience to add these new names, but there it is. Now, you might say, what force does this have? Good question. They decided to deposit the GTLD MOU into the hands of the International Telecommunications Union, an intergovernmental treaty organization, subsidiary of the UN, located, I believe, in Geneva, who is known most in lay circles for creating country codes. As you figure, somebody, when you dial a telephone, has to keep the country code straight. It can only be one number per country, or at least one country per number. And in a completely fair and democratic way, they're the ones that said that Ecuador would be 593 and the United States would be 1. All right, so they deposit it at the International Telecommunications Union. By the way, we just got some Iridium phones in. These are these satellite phones from Motorola. They're terrible, but in the meantime, they have their own country code. Actually, their own country, which makes every call to them very expensive. So they deposit at the ITU, and anybody can sign the TTLB MOU. So, you know, people can sign it. To my knowledge, you can still sign it. If you'd like to, as sort of an interesting experience in the real world, you can try to see if you can sign the GPLD MOU. And the idea was that if enough people and firms signed the thing, eventually it would be soup, and then it would become reality. And this is an exercise in creating something out of nothing. So how would they know when it was soup? How many names are enough? Well, ultimately, the idea was John would say it was soup and go ahead and add the new seven names that they had proposed, like NOM and FIRM and things like that, to the root. And then away you would go. Now, there were many people who didn't like it. There's actually one website now gone, but which I managed to save before it vanished. Stop the Internet Coup. Oppose the GTLD MOU, the Internet Society, and IANA. Your vital interests in the Internet are in serious jeopardy. A group of self-appointed autocrats have declared themselves rulers of the Internet without regard to international law, the stability of the Internet, and the rights of you and your organization. Join with the Association for Interactive Media and the Open Internet Congress, to my knowledge, not incorporated, no officers, no legal personality, to stop this coup. Their weapon is the generic top-level domain memorandum of understanding. They need some PR work, don't they? It's hard to, you know, even with this introduction, they get that up in arms about it. This document is disguised as an innocent standards agreement regarding domain names. Make no mistake. It actually assigns permanent control over the Internet to six tightly controlled non-representative organizations. If you sign the GTLD MOU, you will give up all of your rights to have any say on the structure and management of the Internet forever. Okay, so this person had some issues with the GTLB MOU. And indeed, this leads to a constitutional crisis. Leads to a constitutional crisis because at some key point along the way, John Postel, just as he got tired of running ComNet and Org out of his research center, decided that he didn't want to run the root anymore either. Because what happens if somebody kicks the plug out of his Macintosh and the root goes down? Within a short period of time, the entire Internet domain name resolution scheme goes down, and that would be inconvenient for a number of people. So he actually agrees with NSI, Network Solutions. He says, look, you guys are up 24/7. You've got, you know, air-conditioned rooms for your computers because you're running these big com, net, and org lists. Why don't you guys run the root file? The file that actually says where com, net, and org are and all the country codes, and that's it. It's a very small file, right? It's just the generic top-level domains and where they can be found, and then the 200-odd country codes. So Network Solutions says, sure, we'll do it. And indeed, if you take a look, here's a wonderful map. The DNS root servers, there is one authoritative server located right here, it looks kind of like ground zero, in Herndon, Virginia, A, the A root server. That's the authoritative root. And in the meantime, just in case somebody were to kick the plug out of NSI's computers, there are mirror roots. There are 12 mirror roots, and here are their locations. There's the M server at Keio University in Japan, the B and L servers at John Postel's old haunt, the University of Southern California. NASA runs one. There's one in Stockholm, London, and the rest are in the Washington, D.C. area. One is run by the U.S. Army. Another is run by Network Solutions. Boeing runs one. They might say, under what authority do they run these? I don't know. They agreed to do it on a handshake. Now, if you consult any of these routes, you'll get the same answer. If you were to get different answers, that would be problematic, because then you would again have a lack of resolution about, no pun intended, which name is meant to go to which computer. So A is the authoritative root, and it's in the hands of Network Solutions. Network Solutions tells John in no uncertain terms, if you tell us to add these seven new names, we'll tell you to take a hike. In which case, the fact that you don't run the internet will become known to all. You'll be embarrassed. It'll just be a mess. So why don't you just lay off? John is not very happy with that answer to a question he hadn't yet asked. But it does prevent him from asking the question, which is, will you add these new names in? So we now have a constitutional crisis. One way that John attempts to resolve it is to say, you know, I'm pals with most of these mirror routes, right? Most of these B, C, D, E root servers. If they were to agree to listen to my root that I could create tomorrow, because after all, it's a small file, instead of NFI's, don't I become the internet? So he performed a test. He had six of the 12 mirror routes direct their computers to him to get their information about where ComNetNord was and all the other top-level domains. Now, he gave them the same information that they would have gotten from NSI, so there was absolutely no noticeable difference to the internet-using public. There was, however, a difference noticed by Network Solutions. A hue and cry was raised, and John was accused of an internet coup. At one time, he was contacted by the FBI, and under strong pressure from the United States government, had to back off. The six mirrors went back to Network Solutions, and the logjam remained. So how do we break the logjam? The Department of Commerce steps in. Ira Magaziner, fresh off his victories in healthcare, is asked by the president to take on the administration's internet policy. And he does this with gusto. He drafts something called the Green Paper. The Green Paper, let's just see if I... The Green Paper is a document meant to say, here's how we're really going to solve it for the long term. It's clear that the GTLD MOU didn't work. It's now dead letter. Although for an interesting time, you can go to gtld-mou.org, and there's still this ghost there. You can go there, and they're still giving you news as if there is a GTLD MOU. Indeed, I think you still might be able to sign it, but it's dead letter. Nobody's expecting anything to happen with it anymore. The Green Paper comes out. It suggests a way out of this bind. Revisions are made with Ira Magaziner this time, the Commerce Department holding the quill, and becomes finalized in the White Paper. The White Paper is the final version of the Green Paper. And in next week's readings, it's there in its entirety. It's actually a mercifully short document for what it tries to cover. And the White Paper says, we're noticing that that contract that the National Science Foundation entered into with John and separately with Network Solutions way back in 92 and 93 is about to expire on September 30th, 1998. When it expires, we want a whole new scheme. And that was originally the research contract for which Network Solutions was allowed to charge ultimately for the names. So by September 30th, we want the internet community at large to come forward with a proposal about how to solve this. So the White Paper was not in itself a solution. It was a solicitation for a solution, preferably only one. Do not give us choices, and then that would be the solution. So throughout the summer of 1998, last year, the internet community at large was tasked with coming up with an answer to the White Paper. Now, if you were the internet community at large, how would you answer the White Paper? Well, for one thing, you're not sure who you are. It's a very unclear process. So different people took it different ways. John's reading of the White Paper was, IANA should start a new process, get public input, just like an RFC. We'll put out some draft bylaws of a new organization, NewCo, that will run this thing, a new IANA, and eventually it'll be done, and we'll submit it to the government, and away we'll go. Well, something else called the International Forum on the White Paper, the IFWP, was convened in Reston, Virginia, in the summer of 1998. And I actually went to that along with some other people from here, very interested to see what would happen. If you went around then, you would find that everybody said they were not there to participate, they were only there to watch and see what would happen. There's not a single participant of the IFWP at first, only people watching. I'm reminded actually of Freedom Air. Remember this airline? It was the smokers airline. It got around the federal rules by being a private club, and then you joined Freedom Air and you could fly and smoke to your heart's content. And the charter flight of Freedom Air was 96 journalists, one very bemused smoker who was, you know, giving interviews, and that was, I think, the only flight of Freedom Air. So the ISWP convenes, and it has its meeting, and it's run actually by a wonderful person by the name of Tamar Frankel. Tamar is a professor of corporations at Boston University. She's also now a fellow of the Berkman Center. She was asked to chair the meeting. It's not clear who asked her. And there's a steering committee of a sort, but it wasn't entirely certain who was on it. But she agreed to chair the meeting and just try to see if she could get consensus going. Consensus was the key word. And sure enough, it was asked that moderators simply come forward. An agenda was published, and then at that agenda, you'd go to that room at that time, and the room, the people who got in the room, should somehow select a moderator who would then moderate a discussion and take notes. So this is what happened. Moderators actually got up and like, hi, I'm Carl back. I'm going to be moderating this session. And we're like, yeah, apparently Carl will be moderating this session. And the session was moderated. It took notes. And, you know, and all right, so you go along. And indeed, the ISWP had a succession of meetings over the course of the summer. Geneva, Singapore, and the final one in Buenos Aires, documenting what consensus it could. And there was a real sense that it was on to something. The only problem was that one way it had avoided any dissonance was by not actually having to come to any decisions. It was just airing views, noting where there was consensus, noting where there wasn't, and that was the end of the story. In the meantime, John Postel was busily putting out successive drafts of bylaws of a new entity and was very chary of this IFWP. Network Solutions liked the IFWP a lot, decided it was the voice of the Internet community, and as the summer started to wane and September 30th neared, offered up its own Internet Community Consensus bylaws for a new entity that would manage domain names and numbers, written by NSI, but no ownership, happy to contribute it to the Internet community at large and see what happens. Indeed, at one point they asked that it be called the Harvard Draft, and we politely declined. They were at loggerheads, and as the second week of September came about, it was clear that Network Solutions and John Postel, IANA, could not come to agreement. And if they couldn't, warned Ira Magaziner, through himself and through his various people that could speak for him, they said, this is going to be bad. I am not going to approve something that you guys haven't agreed to, because then there won't be consensus, and we're going to have a big fight over who really owns the Internet. So he wanted to see these two parties come together. They actually initially proposed that they come together here, and we just have a big meeting in a room, and somehow we would decide who would be there, and they would include Network Solutions and IANA. And at the end of it, we'd be locked in the room. We wouldn't be allowed out until we had an agreement. IANA steadfastly refused, and in fact, ultimately, IANA and Network Solutions went into a back room in Washington, conducted private negotiations. At the 11th hour, emerged with a deal called ICANN, and asked that the meeting here, which had never really been scheduled, be canceled. There were a number of people anticipating our meeting, just Internet citizens, who had scheduled flights to Boston to attend that were non-refundable. So they came to Boston anyway, and they formed the Boston Working Group, which provided a critique of the ICANN bylaws as agreed to by Network Solutions and IANA. September 30th rolls around. By this time, John has done one more revision to the ICANN now bylaws, the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers. And that one revision took out most of what it appears he agreed to in the negotiations with NSI. By that time, NSI had other things to worry about, and the proposal was submitted on September 30th, along with a proposal from the Boston Working Group critiquing it, and from one other small group. The Department of Commerce thought about it, and as time went on, John, who had been in the hospital with heart surgery, died, and left the Department of Commerce in somewhat of a bind, because they had to say yes, and they didn't know to whom they were saying yes anymore. The attorney that John had retained pro bono, a guy by the name of Joe Sims from Jones Day in Washington, had an idea. He went ahead and incorporated the company that he had proposed to the Department of Commerce, and then said, Department of Commerce, just say yes to the company. And then you said yes to the company appoints him as the lawyer, and away we go. So that's what happened. ICANN came into existence and was charged with an initial board that had been selected by John and apparently several others. This is an item of contention among some as to who picked this board. But it had its own board, which then appointed its own CEO, and there was ICANN, without a budget, to be sure, but one recognized by the Department of Commerce. And that brought us to the fall of 98, with ICANN now being charged with figuring out such issues as how to expand the namespace, how to, and whether there should be a uniform dispute resolution policy, such that if somebody doesn't like your domain name because they think it's their trademark and you're abusing it, they don't have to take you to court. Instead, they could go to some alternate panel and divest you of it relatively easily. These sorts of things ICANN was supposed to decide with input from the internet community at large. And that is the part of the story I'd like to tell for now. And we will leave the rest of the story for next week. And in the meetings, you'll get most of the rest of the story of what happened with ICANN from then till now. And in fact, next week we'll have some folks from ICANN here to talk about it. Now that we've gone through so many acronyms, I thought I could now add my own. INF, the TNT of C. You will never see this again. It's just a very poor joke. But it's Internet Science, Technologies, and Politics of Control. I take the subtitle seriously, believe it or not. And now I just want to kind of give you an overview of what to expect in this course. An initial warning. When I was in college, we had things called GUTs. Does anyone know what a GUT is? Yeah? All right, a GUT is that a course so easy as to be a little bit embarrassing. But you take it nonetheless, because after all, it's easy. GUTs were often denoted. There was sort of a subtext of GUTdom, signified by the presence of an ampersand in the title of the course, and or the presence of society in the title of the course. So there may be people here thinking they've got a double bonus because it's and society, and maybe even a third component of a subtitle. How can this be a hard course? And in some sense, it's not a hard course. I hope it won't be in the sense that it will be engaging most of the time, interesting, fun, relevant to the world at large, whether you're just going to be using the internet because you exist today or you want to be a cyber lawyer of some kind in the future. There will be ways in which it won't be a GUT. Namely, there'll be a regular amount of work expected of you. I give you my promise, it won't be busy work, it won't be problem sets, it'll actually be real work, which means thinking hard about issues, trying to come up with original ideas on them, and then expressing them in some tangible medium. This kind of work will be due each week in a way that I'm about to explain. So it's both easy and hard in just the ways I've described. It's also hard in the way that in many ways we are experimenting. One change from last year. Maybe people here who took the course last year, I'm happy that you're here, but you shouldn't try to take it again. But in the meantime, one change from last year is that we will be integrating the net increasingly into the class itself. That's right, McLuhan's message and medium will meet, with any luck, in this class. You'll notice we are in the newly renovated Bornberg room. It has jacks all over the place. These ashtrays are not ashtrays, in fact. Please don't smoke. This is not freedom class. But you'll notice that in the ashtrays there are actually two Ethernet connections and two AC power adapters. This has actually caused some great consternation among the faculty, I understand, because they're worried that it's going to be like checking their email instead of learning about our federalism. Now, by that, I think by fiat, these jacks have actually been turned off. You may even been trying to use them today. I don't think they work. Mine doesn't work up here, so you can't have it if I can't have it. But in the meantime, this is an interesting eventuality, isn't it? We've renovated a room. We put lots of money into it. In fact, this room has been renovated twice in the past 2 years. This is the second renovation. And there is Ethernet at every seat. And it's a threat. You might wonder, well, what were they thinking? Why is there Ethernet at every seat? Does anybody know why there's Ethernet at every seat in the law school classroom here? I don't think anybody knows. But here it is. Internet and society, all right? So we've got Ethernet at every seat. I vow to find something useful to do with it by the end of this class. And we are collectively guinea pigs at trying to figure out some good use for all the effort that's gone in to these ashtrays. And I mean it not only just as a way of making use of what's in front of us, supply creates demand, but also as a way of saying, asking the question, epiphenomenal to the substantive cyber law questions we'll be asking over the course of the term, what does it mean to have education in an internet environment? What does it mean to learn in a place that looks to Christopher Columbus Langdell from many years ago for its model of how pedagogy should be, and a model that I should make clear to the bugs in the room. I like it. It's great. But there may be some room for improvement, and we will be experimenting with different ways of that. And experiments, of course, are always liable to fail. They're wonderful learning experiences, but in the meantime can be quite frustrating when they get on your trousers. So just realize that a lot of the class will have elements of experimentation. If you don't feel you're an adventurous sort, you have been warned. Okay, so what are the actual substance that we're going to cover over the course of the term? There is a reading packet that I'm told is now available at the distribution center, conveniently labeled, which has next week's reading in it. And the very first page after is the syllabus in very abbreviated form of the whole term, so you'll be able to get some details. But what are we going to cover? There are basically three anchor points of substance we'll be looking at: privacy, property, and speech. And it turns out that these are all the same thing. There is actually a grand unified theorem of all this. If the classes start seeming repetitive, it's a benefit. That's why. They actually do interface in wonderful ways. It turns out that when you think of property in a net environment, one for which it's data at the end of the day, that's the fundamental unit, right? Intellectual property of that sort is speech, too. Indeed, an argument that's been made is that encrypted speech is a form of speech and therefore is protected under the First Amendment. So you can't restrict encryption without running afoul of the First Amendment any more than you could ban German in the United States. So there's a wonderful relationship between speech and property that we'll be looking at. And indeed, privacy comes into it too, because as increasingly the ashtrays around us have tobacco taken out and Ethernet put in, whether we're in our car or in our house or in our classroom or in our law firm, there are ways in which the ubiquity of it will bear on our degree of privacy. And part of the point of this course is that stuff that seems abstruse, if somebody had asked you earlier today about ICANN, IANA, IETF, and internet numbering, I agree it is abstruse as can be. But part of the argument of this course is it actually bears on real policy issues. And without having at least some working ability with the underlying technology, at least a lack of fear of it, it's very difficult to actually address the policy. And indeed, if anybody here is a fan of Larry Lessig, one of his underlying messages is, you know, code is law. He actually divides the world into West Coast coders and East Coast coders. The East Coast coders live in Washington, D.C., and we know how they work. We may not like it, but we know how they work. They sit in Congress, they write laws, and that's code that we then have to listen to, the U.S. code. Then there are West Coast coders, Silicon Valley and Redmond, Washington. And the West Coast coders also make code, and that's code we have to live with. And indeed, so much of what we take for granted in code on the West Coast, we don't on the East Coast. Somebody passes a law we don't like, we get mad. Somebody passes a code we don't like on the West Coast, and we just assume that's the way it had to be. You know, did there have to be country codes? Of course not. What a weird imposition of geography on what so many people like to say is a geography-less medium. But already, you've got a country code for Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia has a web form, we can see at some point, by which you can recommend sites that be terminated from the Saudi Arabian country code because they have objectionable content to them. So the technical decisions that are being made, make no mistake, have implications on policy that are quite grand. And indeed, one of the tasks between this week and next is to figure out, does ICANN fit into this category? Is it just kind of a sort of interesting story, or is it something that really bears on fundamental issues like the three here as we know it? My answer is already yes, but you need to be convinced of that. Let me say a word about cyber law. This course could have been called Cyber Law, thereby omitting the ampersand, the subtitle, and the society. But there's a reason why it's not called Cyber Law. Cyber Law is a new subfield of law. As such, its first defining task is to justify its existence against a hostile band of people that aren't cyber law people. There's a famous article by Judge Easterbrook called The Law of the Horse. From a symposium, cyber law symposium. He was invited to give the keynote. What does he do? He shows up and he says, go home. There's no such thing as cyber law. It's like a law of the horse. What would a law of the horse be? Well, I don't know, a codification of what happens if you steal a horse, how to own a horse. You know, is there restrictions on riding a horse? And you'd realize, well, that's stupid, right? There's criminal law for stealing things, and there is property law for who owns things, et cetera, et cetera. So the question is cyber law something other than a big pile of cases drawn from Grimm, Torch, CivPro, you know, your classic first year lineup, that happen to involve computers and networks? To read some cyber law syllabi in textbooks, you may be hard pressed to find where the gestalt is. Where is the like there that makes this a field other than the sum of the parts of other fields? Now, I believe there is a there, but it will be found not so much in doctrine, not so much in mastering quickly trademark law and then hurriedly trying to apply it to whether you could get a trademark interest in .per and thereby sue everybody else who might try to register under it out of existence. An interesting question, one that the per guy threatens to do, but not a critical question to what I think of as cyber law. So in some ways, I'm setting aside a lot of what you might expect the traditional doctrine to be. You'll notice that I asked on the survey that 70 of you filled out, have you had experience in con law before? Have you had experience in IP? So much of the net issues that we talk about bear with and on intellectual property, it's very helpful for me to know how up to speed people are. And to be sure, we'll be learning some of that as we go. But that's not going to be the primary focus. What is the primary focus? Tech shifts the baseline, law shifts it back. What does that mean? That means that when you pass a law, think about East Coast Code for a second. You pass a law, you pass it in a world that exists. You don't pass law in a vacuum. You say, don't speed. You can't go over 65 miles an hour. You do it in a world in which cars are capable of going over 65 miles an hour. You do it in a world where there are guardrails that work up to about that speed, but if you go any faster, you really total your car if you run into one of them. I mean, there's all sorts of architecture or nature facts that you take into account when you pass a law. And the question would be then, what happens if nature suddenly changes? Now, nature doesn't usually change. It's nature, after all. But part of the argument about what makes cyber law is, to the extent that we're talking within an internet environment, one wholly built by people, people who hum in rooms, it's one that could change in a heartbeat. It's one that you wonder, well, what went into this environment? What made it this way? Why is it that when I surf the net today, by and large, if I send an email and simply change the fields around to say that I am GNU at GNU.org, nobody knows who I am. I mean, isn't that weird? You can just put it in. Actually, there's a law school policy against it, right? There's a law school anti-anonymity policy that says you are not allowed to go into your Netscape on the law school network and change your name to GNU, unless your name is GNU. No offense intended. That's a change in nature. So it was harder to be anonymous before. If you were going to leaflet or something, maybe you could leave your name off, but you know, you had to really skulk about and do so in a way that you wouldn't be found distributing the leaflets. Now you can do it from the privacy of your own computer. That's a change in nature that law hasn't yet accounted for. So then you say, if nature changes the baseline, should law shift it back? Should we pass a law, or should ITS, for example, adopt a policy that says, you know, you couldn't be anonymous before, now it's really easy, you're not allowed to do it, and bring things back to an equilibrium that was one that may not have been a policy equilibrium, just one that is accounted for by a state of nature. Another great example that we're going to be looking at the week after next is on encryption. Encryption is the ability to take information and make it so that anybody but you and the person you intend it for will have a really hard time reading it. Or, in the worst terror of the FBI, doing it to phone conversation. So they can no longer just plug in to see what, you know, Jimmy is up to. Instead, they have to listen and they hear a bunch of junk because your phone conversation is scrambled. Another of those use a stew phone, a secure telephone unit. It's very get smart. You kind of pick up the thing and you're like, all right, are you ready to go secure? Ready, okay. And you press the button at the same time, the phone goes wonk. And then it's like talking in a cone of silence. You can barely hear them. They sound like a kitten kind of mewling at you. And you end up having to bellow to be heard, which actually eliminates part of the purpose of the phone, which is to be discreet. So this is why you can't get them yet at the coop. But they're working on it. And you have the law react by saying, my lord, we had a baseline. We had an equilibrium. What was the equilibrium? It was one where if we get a warrant, we can listen to your phone call. Now, to be sure, phone calls were a change in nature. There was a time when there weren't phone calls, there just weren't phones. Now there are, and then there was technology to listen in, and we're happy with that. And now there's this technology to encrypt it. We need to have law shift the baseline back. Traditional reaction level, we have the East Coast coders outlaw what the West Coast coders have done in some fashion. Another reasonable question to ask is, well, then who shifts the tech? Law may say, we outlaw this technology, or even better, we outlaw this behavior that uses this technology. We're not trying to make Netscape change the way their field that you identify your email address works. We're just going to make you change your behavior so you don't type in the name we don't want you to type in. You then start saying, well, then who controls the technology? Now, the tentative answers, I mean, the first answer is, I don't know. The second answer, when you think about it a little or do some research, is, well, the markets. There are market forces at work so that people who do technology would like to be able to sell it eventually. So they do focus groups. And in that way, it's consumer-driven. You can call this the Microsoft model. And that's how stuff gets done, just like that's how lamps. Who controls what lamps look like? Well, I don't know. We, the lamp-using public, do our focus groups. But then there's this other model. Microsoft is not the only source of software in the world, believe it or not. There's a whole other model, which is this kind of fuzzy IETF model. So-called open standards. These guys aren't in it for the money, which is very strange. And they don't listen to consumers necessarily. They do what works for them. Who might ask of Microsoft that they implement something one way versus another? Or ask of the IETF people that they implement something one way or the other? It's a very good question. And it's a question that we face even with this ICANN story I've been telling. Who really owns the root? Is it the property of Network Solutions? Is it the United States government? These obvious questions actually have very vague answers that the closer you get to somebody in a position to answer them, the less they want to hold forth on them. So it gets into issues of governance and law power, and that's where we fall back to the subtitle of this course, The Technologies and Politics of Control. The Internet has arrived. It's now realized to be either such of value unto itself, just as these domain names are of value, or alternatively, such an instrument of social expression. I hate to sound like a sociologist, but an instrument of social expression, right? You're going to use the Internet to get your word out about the atrocities in Kosovo. Or you're going to use the Internet to exchange email with your illicit lover. I mean, there's all sorts of things you do that now implicate the Internet that governments, now that the rest of the world, apart from the techies, has discovered the Internet, are worried about. They're worried that you're going to gamble over the Internet. You're going to look at pornography over the Internet, all sorts of things like that. That you will try to find young kids over the Internet. That's one of the major terrors of the FBI and one of the areas in which they focused their enforcement efforts. So there's a battle not just to have the behaviors that are undesirable curtailed the way that ITS tries to curtail anonymity, but rather a battle over the actual structure of the Internet itself and whether it and the computers attached to it will be amenable to the kinds of uses that are liked or not liked by different sovereigns or different powers. And it's that fight for control that I want this course to really focus on. And law figures into it both literally, because law is an instrument of power, and it figures into it the opposite way too, because law at its base is simply constraint. That's what law is. And constraint can come then from sources other than East Coast coders. And getting to see Microsoft Word as a form of law, a statute that you have to parse as you use it, and that you are bound by if you choose to use the software, is an important step in realizing the kind of fungibility of these concepts. So for each class, we're going to say, what are the interests at stake? Who really cares about this? And what are they doing to vindicate their interests? What means are they using? Who knows and owns the tech? I guess I've already talked about that. Open versus closed bears a little bit on this IETF versus Microsoft question. Microsoft, by the way, is not the only paragon of closed code in the world. Most professional software companies believe in so-called proprietary code. They own it. You license it. If you don't like it, go use someone else's. But there are other models out there as well that are even vying with the closed code predominance. And in the meantime, law that bears on whether your code can be open or closed. It's only thanks to copyright law that you are able to take code that you've generated, remember code is speech, and prevent anybody else from saying it, from copying it, from using it without your say-so. That's a government policy. That's not just an inherent ownership, the way you might think of holding a stick or a bucket. And indeed, that leads to a final question that comes out as we talk. I say, what's a right? When you think of rights in the law school context, you think of legally protected interests. Legally protected interests are rights because the state says it's a right. You have a right to free speech, which means you can go out onto the middle of the Cambridge Commons, say what you please, and if the cops come to take you away, you get to hold the First Amendment up, and the piece of paper is like a cross to Dracula. They run away. So it's sort of this free chit played against constraint. Police are trying to constrain you. You say, wait, I've got a right to be here. I've got a right to be secure in my papers and effects in my house. I've got a right to this, a right to that. It's primarily constraint as against the state, when you think of it in the classic law school way. Right? We all know incorporation doctrine, but it limits itself to state action. It's only as against the state that you can play the First Amendment card. So one question then is, in cyberspace, when the functions of the state, the post office, for example, the post office is something that is, in America, a state function, in most other countries too. Email, which is a wonderful corollary you can take to some degree, is private. There's no public post office in cyberspace. It's a series of private companies that trade the mail on the basis of protocols developed by the unincorporated IETF people. That's email. So then you say, well, what happens if someone censors your email? What would it mean for your email to be censored? And what right might you claim against some censorship? And wouldn't that right then, since there's no state action, fall flat in a court here on constitutional terms? And also, wouldn't it ultimately go up against the right of the private entity that's trying to censor you, their right to do what they please with their instrumentality? Who are we to tell Mindspring what kind of mail goes through their server or not? So this leads to all sorts of questions about state action and indeed about public and private. So much of the internet is private. Almost none of it is run by governments. No component. And yet so much of it we take for granted as a kind of public space. If you want to get up onto the web, you can do so, and you think of it as a matter of right. So there's a line going through cyber law. There's the does ICANN matter question, which we've already asked. And there's a blank screen, which means it's time to have the final slide appear, making a big class into a small class. I'm aware of how this is now a big class. There's no way to hide it. The initial INF seminar was 30 people, a seminar of 30 people. The INF small class last year had 45. We now, unless I've driven everybody off, as I hoped, unless everybody leaves, we still have a big class. And I am intent on doing what can be done not to have this be a big class. Mark my words, this day is unusual in that I have blathered at you for an hour and 15 minutes. This will not happen again. Other people will blather at you from panels. We'll have dialogues among ourselves. We'll roam the aisles. But this is, to whatever extent I can make it, going to be an interactive class, not a lecture class. And here are some ways in which I'm hoping to make that happen. Way number one is something called the rotisserie. People may be familiar with this from last year. The rotisserie is a mechanism, I'll explain how it worked last year, by which I could ask a question of the class. After this class, I might ask a question such as, who owns the root? And then you think about it, and let's say it meets every Thursday, which from what I can tell this class does. By Wednesday at midnight, you offer an answer to the question. You go onto the web, you fill in the box with the answer, and you click submit. If you wait till after midnight, the submit box goes away. It's ruthlessly enforced by the code, which is good because I'm a complete pushover, as rumor may have it. But now there's the code in between me and you, and if you don't get in by Wednesday at midnight, there's nothing to be done. At that point, everybody who answered has his or her answer routed randomly to one other student in the class for reaction. So somebody else in this class is going to read over what you said and will have until Friday midnight, say, to react to it. And you, in turn, will be asked to react to somebody else's answer by Friday midnight. Kind of weird. Worked very well last year. and we are planning to put it to even more and different use this year. And we're about to have a chance to get into questions about things. I'm sure there'll be plenty of them. And we have two teaching fellows for the class, too, a new addition to the structure, Alex and Becca. I don't know where Becca is. Ah, Becca. Hi, Becca. They'll be able to help with the questions, too. But the rotisserie is one way we're going to try to keep it a small class kind of atmosphere, and one where you're actually meeting other people in the class, and a few wild cards. For instance, there are different cyber luminaries who have agreed to be guests in the rotisserie, so even if they aren't in class, they will join in and answer the question and may critique yours. So that will be one way. Also note that this is a 3-credit class, despite only 2 hours of in-class meetings. This is why. So this is the bonus credit for actually enduring and benefiting from the rotisserie. Also, the new version of the rotisserie, I believe, has something called late chips in it. By popular request from last year, there's now an ability every so often to say, you know, I just can't deal this week, and you click, I don't want to submit, and the software forgives you. So active, varied participation. There's got to be a reason why I put that, because it's so obvious. Why would I put it just, you know, of course, active, varied participation? I guess what I mean by that is, it's a euphemism. It means I reserve the right to call on people, which is just sort of masked time behavior. You know you all want it until you're called on. But you all want it because then it prevents certain people who are eager and have lots to offer, but who after a while shouldn't be the only people in the class who talk, from talking all the time. And indeed, we actually are experimenting with a technological way to put some fun into the process of actually interacting. So parts of the class will involve varied participation enforced through the cold call. So there you go. Glad people didn't bring fruits and vegetables to throw. It's fun, right? I mean, this is a good thing. Okay, that's a laugh of approval. I hear a consensus. Class scribing. At ICANN meetings, one problem ICANN faced was it's supposed to be an international organization, and yet it has to meet somewhere. So immediately, everybody greater than 50 miles away from that place has been marginalized, excluded, and their rights trod upon. So ICANN said, first, too bad, and second, we're going to have remote participation so that you can actually partake of the meeting, see it on a real audio, real video stream, see notes popping up. You can actually be part of the meeting while you're not physically there. And we have been helping them develop such means. And in addition, while the conversation is happening, there's literally a scribe, and there's a screen up in the corner where the scribe takes notes and captures the conversation as it's taking place. That way, if you're not there, you have a permanent reference of what happened. And if you are here, it actually releases you a little bit from the burden of having to take notes. Instead, you can just focus on the actual action and have some way of seeing structure unfold, with any luck, as it does. So we're going to do a demonstration of this scribing in a future class soon, and then be asking for volunteers among the class here to actually perform this function for one or another class. Listserv, with no E on the end. Listserv is a mailing list where you send an email and it goes to everybody else on the list, and then they send an email and it goes to everybody on the list. How many people have been on a listserv before? All right, most people. Part of integrating media methods is to actually, by way of example from ICANN, getting you into the debate a little bit. As you do your reading, I will be taking license, be warned, and signing you up to a listserv, which is our listserv. It's the INS99 TNPFC listserv, to which I have also invited some of the principals of the debates over ICANN. This will be your opportunity to ask questions. I encourage you to do so, realizing that the answers won't just be coming from me as one view, but from a bunch of people in the debate. And indeed, as they get added to the list, I'll be asking them to introduce themselves to the group and maybe answer a question about what they think about ICANN. I'm asking that you be on this listserv for a week. At the end of the week, you may want off, and that will be fine. We'll see where it goes. But in the meantime, with any luck, starting tomorrow, Friday, I will be getting everybody's email into the hopper, and there will be this listserv. And it may result in a voluminous amount of mail. We're going to be studying the spam problem later this term. We will now actually have some real basis to go on about dealing with spam, about harmful speech, and indeed about online governance. What do you do with the one guy who turns out to be a complete fraud and who comprises fully 50% of the messages on the listserv? this question and others will have to be answered by this class by next Friday by living on this listserv. So that's one other thing that will happen. Here's an interesting bullet point. MIT/Denmark. Hal Abelson is a professor at MIT and a brilliant guy who knows the tech better than anybody I know. He teaches a class over there called 6805. Things only have numbers at MIT ever since they gave up the domain name system. So 6805 overlaps significantly with the sorts of things we're doing, and it will literally overlap at several times during the term, you'll see it in the syllabus, with this class. The actual people from MIT will haul over here and sit in this room. At last, the front will have to be filled with unsuspecting MIT students, and we will be meeting together and finding some way to actually have the engineers that will be in the room then talking to the many lawyers we have in the room. So we'll also find them, with any luck, in the rotisserie. So where our syllabi overlap, there will be questions posed to them that you will react to and vice versa, and somehow it's all going to work. You may be wondering, how big is this class? It's a lot smaller than ours, so don't worry about seats. Denmark. There's a guy in Denmark named Wolfgang Kleinwachter who teaches a class on cyber law and also wants to participate in our rotisserie. Software willing, why not? It'll be an interesting opportunity. And ultimately, getting back to the question of what do we do with our Ethernet jacks, put more grandly as, what does it mean to have education in a networked environment? It may well mean that routinely, instead of it just being a single class in a classroom with, you know, one or two people teaching at the front of it, you actually are starting to interact with a bunch of other people around the world that are studying the kinds of issues that you're studying here and hearing the kind of party line they're being told by their professors and comparing notes to what you're being told and seeing what happens. So this should be interesting. But in the meantime, don't be surprised if people with umlauts are participating in the rotisserie. Finally, a moot court. This was a lot of fun last year. Next year, which is to say this year, we'll have another moot court. The topic will be, I don't know if anybody has heard of the Nuremberg Files. I remember actually once on CNN, on their travel channel, don't ask them how about the travel channel, that they said something like, Nuremberg is known for three things. It's, you know, delicious sausages, it's garden-lined streets, and it's great views. But, you know, I think of other things when I think of Nuremberg. But in the meantime, anybody from Nuremberg here? Sorry. The Nuremberg Files is a website. What's a website? Is a website? I'm not sure. It was a website that is run by people who think that abortion is murder. And it believes that the rest of the world that doesn't believe that will soon see the light. And when they do, they will want to convene a Nuremberg-like tribunal from World War II, post-World War II, to judge those who participated in this murder. To that end, they want to preserve and present evidence for such a tribunal. So they solicit people on the internet at large to come to them with information, particularly about physicians who perform abortions. Driver's license number, picture, description, kids, where the kids go to school. Any data you can get, they want, and they will then put it on the website. And indeed, there's a website that lists a bunch of abortion physicians. And as the physicians get killed by anti-abortion violence, a line is put through their name. This was troublesome enough to the United States government that it brought suit under the Freedom of Access to Clinic Entrances Act, saying that this was actually intimidation and fear-mongering designed to preclude the exercise of the right to abortion. A judgment for, I think, over $100 million was returned against the largely insolvent people behind the website, not an injunction, damages. And then the question, of course, was an injunction. Can you actually tell them, all right, now take the site down, or the judge has to actually fashion an order that says the website can do this, but it can't do that. Start putting a line through names, and that's a threat. But, you know, if you just put the names there, that's free speech. A very bizarre question, and one raised by the fact that websites are sort of static. It's not like a pamphlet that goes out that you then decree was wrong. It's out there, and it's still out there, and then as a judge you have to decide whether to restrain it. It never came to that because Mindspring, which was the company that hosted the Nuremberg Files site, decided under its own acceptable use policy that this did not fit and booted them unceremoniously. They came back up in the Netherlands for a while by somebody who purported to hate them but said that they valued free speech above all else, and then disappeared again. I don't know if they are anywhere on the net today. That would be a good question. So anyway, we're going to do a moot court on two legal issues raised by this as if it's on appeal. It should be a lot of fun, and we'll be asking for people to volunteer both to help put it together and to argue it, and that will be in lieu of the small final paper that is due at the end of the course. So next week, there are readings at the distribution center, which I will quickly walk through so that you know what's in there and why. I promise you that the readings for this course will be highly edited. They will be as succinct as possible. They will largely take about 2 hours of your time each week. I hope that you can promise me that in exchange you'll read them. If you don't, you'll find it difficult to answer the rotisserie questions, and generally you'll find yourself lost in class. But I promise at least to make the readings as digestible as possible and not assign anything that you'll resent being assigned later. So the next readings are at the distribution center. You need to immediately hire yourself to a networked computer. Go to that URL. Is that URL right, Alex? cyber.law.harvard.edu/is99. Thought I can call it IS99T and D of C. And register. There's like a little login or register page, and hopefully it will all be self-explanatory. If there isn't, in a document that's about to be handed out to you, which is the frequently asked questions document, it says how to get help. But you should sign up for the rotisserie because there will be questions due for next week that you should do and get ready to experience the listserv that I already referenced. Yes?
Is that site actually up?
As of today, it had something like, you know, place site here. Is the site actually up now?
It'll be up.
15 minutes, I'm told. So don't hire yourself immediately to a network computer, but 15 minutes. Let me just walk through the readings so I'll know we have walked the readings. And in fact, whatever extent I can, which should mean to whatever extent it won't bore the MIT students when they're here, I'm going to try to just go over the readings for next week and just tell you what to expect and why they're in the packet. We finish up on ICANN next week, but we'll find it as something of a theme through the rest of the term. And indeed, the ICANN first annual meeting is the first week of November, which I believe is flyout week. There's no class scheduled here. We will see to it through remote participation that if you are interested, you can attend the meeting remotely and ask all sorts of questions that might be of interest at the ICANN meeting. And indeed, we may even try to get a room together like this so people who want to be in on the meeting can be together and in on the meeting at the same time. So there's a handful of news articles just sort of talking about the ICANN debates of today, which ought to be eminently readable after today's long story. There's a second thing, which is the DAO of IETF. This is a document that's meant to initiate new people into the IETF, and you should take a look at. It has some very interesting provisions. There's a letter from Ralph Nader. You know that this issue has happened when Ralph Nader gets a piece of it. Ralph Nader has got a piece of it and written a letter to Esther Dyson, chair of ICANN, with some hard questions that he thinks ICANN has to answer about its formation and its conduct since it has come about. So I have included his letter and Dyson's answer. There's also the ICANN report to the Commerce Department, which was filed with the Commerce Department on June 15th, saying how things are going. If, as you read this stuff, you still run into questions, feel free to post them to the threaded messaging database that we understand, will be up and running in 15 minutes. And then the Commerce Department white paper. The white paper has taken on this kind of talismanic, biblical significance. People don't lightly disavow the white paper, which if you think about it then is a wonderful triumph for Ira Magaziner. He actually came up with something that people look to as the one lodestone here. And you'll notice that in Esther Dyson's answer to Nader, she constantly is invoking the white paper and saying that she is in tune with it. And often the pattern of an argument against ICANN will be, you've done this, you've killed babies, you've done blah, 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 blah. All in violation of the white paper. So the white paper is there more as a reference document, but if you'd like to plow through the whole thing, there it is. Part of the white paper asks the World Intellectual Property Organization, WIPO, subsidiary of the International Treaty Organization, and largely thought to represent intellectual property interests, to come up with a way of dealing with the cyber squatting problem that ICANN could then implement. WIPO did so after a series of hearings and one very strong dissent to their actions. There is their executive summary available and an answer from a guy by the name of John Gilmore, who may be known to some of you. He goes by GNU. So we have the executive summary, the WIPO report, what they're asking ICANN to do, and GNU's critique of it, as well as Senator Spencer Abraham's answer to the WIPO report, which is to not worry about the report, but instead legislate a solution to the cyber squatting problem, which is now wending its way through Congress. And I've only cursed you with the press release rather than the actual text of the bill. And finally, there is a, I don't know how you say it, primer on trademarks, with particular attention to trademarks as they relate to domain names. And what little doctrine we're going to go through here, we'll go through next week. So with that said, why don't I see if there are questions? We're not over yet, right? We go till 6:10, so don't even think about questions. There can be questions on procedure or about substance. Yes, sir. You want to try out this thing?
Not really.
I know, but what the hell? Let's see if it works. Hello? Hello? Guess what? They're off the hook. No, you're not. What's your name?
Mike.
Mike. I used to know a computer with your name.
I'm just wondering whether the exam schedule shows that there's some sort of final, but you're saying there's a paper. What's...
Did the exam schedule show the final?
Handed out on the last day of class, due the 22nd, something like that.
Really? Which could, by all means, be a paper. I mean, final could be write a paper. So there's an answer to this question. There is no final. There's no final exam. Instead, there's a paper. And the paper is remarkably brief, which means it has to make up for in quality what it will lack in quantity, on the order of 10 to 15 pages. There'll be a point in the term where the rotisserie will ask you to put forth an abstract, what you want to write about, and then at least one other person in the class is going to critique it. It'll also be a chance for me to look over all the abstracts and offer my own critiques. Then you should see it as an opportunity to actually do some really interesting research on many of the unresolved questions here. So that being said, there's no exam, there's only a paper, and the paper will be weighted along with the class participation, the answers on the rotisserie, and some other factor to determine your grade. Yeah?
How are you generating the email address for the listserv?
How am I generating the email addresses for the listserv? I'm going to collect them as you sign up for the rotisserie. Go to that website, it will ask for email address. It will be on the basis of that that I'll get the listserv going. Other questions? Yeah. Yes, there's an optional clinical component to the course. We've got credits. We've got an amazing number of ways to get credits. The course comes with two class credits, one non-class credits, which represents the rotisserie writing, and then if you are interested, there is a way to get involved with certain clinical projects of the Berkman Center in conjunction with this class. And you get extra credits on the basis of that. I think we have some paperwork about it. But generally right now, we have three areas in which you might get involved. One is a case called Eldred v. Reno, which is a challenge mounted by the Berkman Center against the Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act. Mary Bono, Sonny's widow and successor to his seat in Congress, introduced the Sonny Bono Act last fall by saying that if Sonny Bono could have his way, copyright would last forever. Her staff told her there might be a problem with that, so she's only going for another 20 years. That extended in the United States then the length of copyright for most works from 75 to 95 years, and did so retroactively. If you read the Constitution, it has a clause which empowers Congress to create monopolies on speech, known as copyright and patent, and it says that it shall do so for limited times, with the idea being, and if you read some of the documents at the time, people were very concerned about the public domain, that, you know, people ought to have incentive to write, which means they write, and they get this monopoly that they can enforce by having printing presses shut down that aren't paying them the money they've asked for. and after a period of time, they've recouped the money, it's the right thing, and then it becomes public property, and they don't have that right anymore. It now seems as if it might be forever by incrementalism, and indeed it's been applied retroactively. So works that have already been created, which the author has already seen fit to abide by the deal and create the work, are now locked up for another 20 years. There's actually an article about it in the Sunday Boston Globe, which we may have online somewhere, that kind of gets the case. It's a very interesting case, and there are opportunities to weigh in on either side, because Arthur Miller has signed an amicus brief on the other side, defending the act. Larry Lessig has led the charge on the first side. So we're not taking institutionalists, I suppose, a orthodox view about it. The other case, aside from Eldred v. Reno, is called Intel v. Hamidi. A guy named Ken Hamidi was an employee of Intel, the computer chip manufacturer, and had some injury, went for workman's comp, some kind of problem arose with it. He left Intel under a cloud and decided that Intel was a very bad company and decided that he should tell people about that, specifically the people who work at Intel. And he did so by taking a company directory and starting to email everybody at Intel.com saying how terrible Intel was, a newsletter. And he said, if anybody tells me to stop sending the newsletter, I stop. I'm not spamming. I'm just giving them information. And indeed, a number of people have not told me to stop. So Intel said, stop. And he said, no. And Intel said, we'll block you then. They then used technical means to try to filter out his mail. He worked around them and kept mailing to the Intel employees anyway. Intel said, now you've made me really angry, and went to California Superior Court and obtained an injunction that said, you are trespassing on our mail server. It's private property. As a result, you must stop. It's trespass to our chattels. I always confuse chattel and cattle, but a web server apparently is chattel and not cattle. So the California Superior Court told him not to go anywhere near the web server with this mail. And he filed an appeal, arguing, among other things, the First Amendment. The First Amendment claim was dismissed by the California court with a single sentence that said, there's no state action here. Show me the government. Now, you might say, when anti-abortion protesters are hauled away kicking and screaming from private property in an abortion clinic, where is the government there? The government is wearing a badge and hauling them away, and that's why the injunction gets reviewed under the First Amendment. But that wasn't said to the judge. It will be said to the judge in an amicus brief being developed by the Electronic Frontier Foundation and some people of interest through Harvard Law School. So if you're interested in that case, there will be opportunities to work on Intel v. Hamidi. And the third area is ICANN. We've gotten involved with our ears in it. In many ways, it provides a spine to what we're doing, and there are a number of legal issues that could stand for investigation there that aren't merely academic and that might be of use, whether to ICANN or to others. So those are the three rough clinical opportunities available, and I think the fact says how you evince your interest in that. Yes? Yeah, if you want to write an extra paper, aside from the 10 to 15 page thing, including a third year paper or something like that, there are a limited number of slots by which to do that. I've got some slots open tomorrow to meet with people who already are interested in doing that, and there's a way in the fact that describes how to sign up for that. I don't know how much interest there is. I suppose I should just do the efficient thing and say, how many people are interested in doing this, a third year paper in conjunction with the course? All right, so not an unmanageable number, which means we might be able to... Oh, now there's one more. Too bad. You need to write two papers for the class, or you would take your 10 to 15-page paper, and it would become the introduction to a wonderful third-year paper on the subject. But it would also amount to extra credits then, extra writing credits for the paper. So it may well be that we can accommodate everybody who wants to do that. Any other questions? Any questions on substance? No. Alex, Doc, am I missing anything?
Yes. Both Beck and I just want to say that we're basically here to help you through this. The software is experimental. You will find problems, you will find bugs. We're the people who are there to try to help you get through that, try to get the bugs fixed. Same with the syllabus, the reading material, drawings, presentations, they're all experimental.
Well, hey, come on, this is not experimental. This is a real lecture, please.
You get a discount rate on tuition. So it's very important that you use Beck and I as much as possible fast details and then get it.
Maybe I should ask the question again by way of taking a survey, and I won't be offended by the answer. How many people are currently enrolled in or expecting to be enrolled in this class? Okay, how many people are not going to be here next week, or at least not here in a credit capacity? Okay, I saw like a couple hands. All right, so this room should stay. We should not be moving back to Hauser. Okay, any other question? No. I have a couple questions that you probably have that I'll ask myself and then answer. Will there be a break? Usually not. 2 hours is a long time to go, but if Titanic can do it, we'll try to do it too. But at times it may make sense, particularly when we have guest panels. And what I'd like to do is not necessarily have the guest panel dominate the entire class, so they'll kind of do their thing, we'll get into it, and then have a chance to excuse them and take a break, and then return to class. Any other questions I have that are like that, that you are going to think of when you leave? I guess not. So consider me available if you have questions or comments, and welcome.